From the studios of Jazz 89 KUVO in Denver, Colorado, WAMU 88.5 presents the Kojo Namdi Show. Welcome, I'm Kojo Namdi. Later in the broadcast, how an Obama presidency might approach judicial nominations. But first, 15,000 journalists all looking for the perfect anecdote or juicy tidbit, all scrambling to meet the demands of an increasingly nonstop news cycle. For the political junkie, it's hard to beat the flood of coverage coming out of their Sears political conventions in Denver and St. Paul. But does that coverage actually make us better informed? Some scholars would say no. They argue that the internet has actually made it harder to be an educated citizen, despite the huge amount of political coverage available online. The reason that we seem to gravitate toward views that reflect our own. Social scientists call it homophily, and it's a habit that's harder to break than you might think. So, is this tendency a danger to democracy? And if so, is there any way to become smarter about how we access political information online? Joining us from the studios of KUVO in Denver is Cass Sunstein. He's a professor at the University of Chicago Law School and co-author of numerous books, including most recently, Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness. Cass Sunstein, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And joining us from studios at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Ethan Zuckerman. He's a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University and co-founder of Global Voices. That's a website that's geared toward, quoting here, shining light on places and people other media often ignore. Ethan Zuckerman, thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you, Kojo.
Ethan, allow me to start with you. Homophily is a fancy word that basically conveys the idea that, well, birds of a feather flock together. What does homophily mean when it comes to our habits online?
Well, homophily is an old social science term. It's actually been used since about the 1950s, and it's a way that people have explained how friendships get formed in communities. People around the world who live in diverse communities have a tendency to form friendships with people who are of the same racial background, of the same ethnographic background, the same religious background. And this has been found in a number of different social science surveys. It's an interesting and sort of open question what this means as we get into internet spaces. And what a lot of researchers are now trying to figure out is in a world of media on the internet where you have literally 100 million people creating content, the possibility of encountering opinions from almost every corner of the world, does this tendency of people to flock together lead to the internet acting as more of an echo chamber than we'd like it to be? The fear is that people can use the internet to find opinions that match opinions that they already hold and to filter out opinions that they might disagree with. And I think the challenge for figuring out how we get news increasingly from interactive media like the internet is to figure out how we get not only the news and information we want, but the news and information that we need.
In case you're just joining us, this is a Tech Tuesday conversation, which you can join by calling 800-433-8850 or sending email to kojo@wamu.org. Ethan, you know, it seems that it's gotten a lot easier with websites like YouTube or dig.com to find information that we would never have come across otherwise. Aren't those kinds of websites helping to break down the echo chamber effect that you just referred to?
Well, I think it's the hope of those sorts of sites. I think looking at Dig and particularly at a similar site, Reddit, is particularly informative. These are sites that invite anybody to submit stories and then sort of vote them up or down based on popularity. And that seems like a wonderfully democratic way to sort of find information. But you've got to ask yourself, who are the people who are using these sites? What are their biases? And how do they align with your own biases? I spend a lot of time looking at Reddit. And one of the things that I've noticed about the site is that it tends to be overwhelmingly from the left politically, either left or libertarian, and has a great deal of technical news, far more than you would find from most other sources. some people on Reddit actually went and then did a survey of the people who are using the site. They're overwhelmingly white, they're overwhelmingly well-educated, they're overwhelmingly extremely young, and they're extremely far to the left politically. So Reddit is an interesting site for me. On the one hand, it agrees with a lot of what I believe. I get a lot of sort of self-reinforcing news there, but I don't necessarily get a lot of diversity. And so I think one of the challenges in all of this is to figure out whether we're getting enough broccoli in our diets. And what I mean by that is it's pretty easy on the internet to find the sort of news that feels very comfortable. It's on topics that you already know are interesting. But I think one of the challenges is to find the information that you need to be a well-informed citizen, to be a diverse person, even if you don't automatically know that you like it or that you want it.
Cass Sunstein, you wrote a book, Republic.com, about this topic 7 years ago. When you first started looking at this, you were very concerned about the Internet's ability to create a sort of filtered reality among citizens. Is that danger more or is it less present today than it was when you first took on this topic?
I don't think we know yet. We don't have enough data about people's patterns of Internet use, but we do know that the fear, that is the echo chamber fear as Ethan describes it, is justified by the pattern of millions of people who on blogs or with news sources restrict themselves not just to topics that they are interested in, but also to points of view that they're interested in. So in a way, the Internet for many people, not at all for all people, is being used to create a kind of communications universe which is just theirs. And it's a comfortable cocoon-like place, but it may make them narrower and angrier and less understanding of their fellow citizens than they would otherwise be.
In Republic.com, you talk about the idea of group polarization, the idea that people who are around people of similar views tend to move toward even more extreme positions. In fact, you did an experiment along these lines in Colorado, the state that we are now in. Can you talk a little bit about that experiment?
Delighted to. And a couple of years ago in Colorado, we got people in Boulder, which is a liberal place, together to talk about climate change, same-sex civil unions, and affirmative action policies. And the Boulder people, we recorded their views before they talked to one another, the anonymous statements of views. We had them talk together and come up with a verdict if they could. And then we had them state their views anonymously afterwards. What we were really interested in was what would happen to their anonymous statements of view after they talked to one another. Would they move to the center? Would they move to the left? Would they agree with each other? What would happen? And here's what we found. In Boulder, they were pretty liberal on these issues before they talked. After they talked, they were super liberal. They moved far to the left after talking with other people in Boulder. The second thing that happened, I think, was even more interesting, that the people in Boulder had some internal disagreements about climate change and same-sex civil unions and affirmative action. After they talked to one another, their internal disagreements were squelched. They ended up being far more uniform in their view. So the echo chamber effect created more extremism and also created more uniformity. They became a little like they were in lockstep with each other. Now, that's what happened to the liberals. We somewhat mischievously did it on the same day in Colorado Springs with the conservatives. We had them talk about the same issues. And they moved to the right, just as our Boulder people moved to the left. The Colorado Springs people, talking to one another, started out pretty conservative. They got really very conservative, much more extreme. And the Colorado Springs people got more uniform in their views, where they were kind of diverse on climate change. They were far less diverse in their anonymous statements of view after they talked with one another. We thought this was illuminating. We hope so, because we think it captures something that's happening not by any means for everyone on the Internet. A lot of people are curious and move from Boulder to Colorado Springs, so to speak. But we think millions of people on the Internet are creating their own Boulder or their own Colorado Springs. And what happens if you do that, we know, is you get more extremism and more uniformity and more contempt and outrage at people who disagree with you.
Cass Sunstein is a professor at the University of Chicago Law School and co-author of numerous books, including most recently Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness. Also joining us from studios at Harvard University in Cambridge is Ethan Zuckerman. He's a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University and co-founder of Global Voices, a website geared towards shining light on places and people that other media often ignore. We're taking your calls at 800-433-8850. Let's go to Bob in Annapolis, Maryland. Bob, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Kojo. It's my first time calling in. Great show. I'm a psychologist and, in my own realm, I've studied human behavior for a good period of time. And it seems to me the issue here is the personality profile of the individual and whether or not they will tend to seek out, a broad array of opinions or not. The Internet is just another medium. I think, of course, people do this, as the professor is saying, in their everyday discourse. And I think the real issue people are going to do this in general, so I don't think it's the Internet that's in any way causing it. I'm sure he's probably not saying that. But I'm hoping the issue is what can we do to kind of present information to people, or how can we form some kind of communities on the Internet or whatnot that will encourage folks to broaden their realm in terms of what they're looking at. That's my comment.
First, you, Cass Sunstein, and then I'd like to hear you weigh in, Ethan Zuckerman.
It's a great point that people have different personalities. Some like to be in those cocoons where everyone is kind of like you and thinks what you do, but other people like to be jarred a little bit, to be surprised, and to be challenged. But I guess I'd add another point, which is that it's not just about the personality. It's kind of about the social context that you live in. And for some of us, the kind of architecture around us has a lot of surprise and serendipity in it, the architecture of serendipity, let's call it, like a daily newspaper. If it's working well, you'll see something on Iran or North Korea or genocide or an Olympic amazing thing that you never would have chosen, but it brings you up short, maybe changes you. That's the architecture of serendipity, and that can get to you even if you're the personality type who likes uniformity. By contrast, you can have with social architecture, you could have something that's very, very uniform, and you can have something that allows you to have complete control. And so what personalities we have interacts with our social context, and the Internet makes it a lot easier to exercise terrific control over the communications that we see.
Now your turn, Ethan Zuckerman.
Well, I think the caller is absolutely right to say that this isn't the fault of the Internet. And Cass's point that the Internet simply makes it easier frequently to just filter your way to the opinions that you want to see is absolutely spot on. I think if you want to put the blame anywhere, you might put the blame on the crisis in American media right now, where we've seen really over the last 30 or 40 years systematically newspapers and TV newscasts giving you less and less hard international news, for instance, and more political horse race. So my interest in this space has less to do with the sort of left-right issues that Professor Sunstein has written so much about, and more to do with whether Americans are really getting a fair international perspective. All that information is out there on the Internet. One of the most amazing things today is that you can go online and read the Mail and Guardian from South Africa, which is a world-class newspaper. But you probably won't unless you're already interested in African issues or unless something sparks you to pay attention to it. There's at least two things that would spark you to pay attention to it. One is sort of a breaking news story that gets covered really well by American media. Unfortunately, that's getting less and less likely over time as American media focuses less and less on the international. The other is, as Cass pointed out, serendipity. Stumbling across something that is provocative, that fits into some interest that you already have, that triggers your interest in a way that you might not have explored previously. One of the things that I think we are in danger of is that as we move to a world where we're grading a great deal of our information online, we haven't thought very much about the architecture of serendipity online. Serendipity is very well architected into a good daily newspaper. Usually you can look at the bottom left-hand corner and there's usually a story from deep within the paper. It may not be the breaking news, but it's been put there by the editors to draw your eye to a topic you might not otherwise have paid attention to. One of the things we need to figure out how to do on the internet is to architect serendipity and to do it in a way that doesn't fall into this homophily trap of just finding information from the people who share a great deal of demographic and psychographic commonality with us.
Ethan Zuckerman is a fellow in the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. He joins us for this Tech Tuesday conversation on technology, politics, and news on the internet. Cass Sunstein is the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. He joins us from the studios of KUVO in Denver, Colorado, where we are for the Democratic National Convention. We're going to take a short break, but you can still call us, 800-433-8850. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Good afternoon. This is WAMU 88.5. Coming up at 2 o'clock, it's Tell Me More from NPR News.
Next time on Tell Me More, our coverage from Denver and the Democratic National Convention continues with a special Mocha Moms. Who in Congress supports legislation that benefits working families? We'll find out who made the cut. I'm Cheryl Corley. We'll talk about family-friendly policymakers. That's next time on Tell Me More.
And that's coming up at 2 o'clock, right after the Kojo Namdi Show here on WAMU 88.5. Then at 3, it's Fresh Air.
On the next Fresh Air, an in-depth comparison of the Obama and McCain health care proposals. We talk with Jonathan Oberlander, who wrote about the partisan divide in health care in the New England Journal of Medicine. Also, Pam Brady and Andrew Fleming talk about writing and directing their new movie, Hamlet 2. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
That's coming up at 3 o'clock today here on WAMU 88.5. Then at 4 on All Things Considered, catch up on all the day's top news, including the latest from the WAMU 88.5 news team.
D.C.'s summer jobs program may be over for the season, but the problem-plagued enterprise is still making headlines. I'm Patrick Madden. I'll have that story this afternoon during All Things Considered, beginning at 4 p.m. right here on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from CDWG. With thousands of technology products in stock, they're there to get public sector customers what they need when they need it on purchasing vehicles specific to their organizations. CDWG, the right technology right away.
It's Tech Tuesday, coming to you from the studios of Jazz 89 KUVO in Denver, Colorado. Our guests are Ethan Zuckerman, fellow in the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University and co-founder of Global Voices, a website geared toward shining light on places and people other media often ignore. Joining us in the studio in Denver is Cass Sunstein. He is the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at Harvard Law School and co-author of numerous books, including most recently, Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness. We're taking your calls at 800-433-8850. Cass Sunstein, it seems that a political convention is the ultimate echo chamber. Do you think the delegates come home after a week with like-minded people and have views that are a bit more radical than when they left home?
Well, I think they end up more confident. They probably end up even more unhappy about the Republican Party than they started. And they probably end up a little less tentative and curious about what good arguments the other side might have.
And Ethan Zuckerman, you are really concerned about narrowing our understanding of international news, which is why you've created Global Voices to try to counter that. Can you tell us a little bit more about Global Voices?
Absolutely. Global Voices is a website and a large community behind it. The website's at globalvoicesonline.org. And there's a large international community dedicated to trying to bring to Americans, and frankly to anyone around the world, opinion, news, perspective from citizen media in the developing world. What that means is that, for instance, in the conflict right now between Russia and Georgia, we are reading Russian and Georgian blogs very, very closely. We have editors who know that region of the world extremely well, and we have translators who are translating from Russian and Georgian so that you can get those perspectives from people who are directly affected by the conflict. The reason we're doing this is that we're deeply worried about the lessening of attention to international news, not only in American news media, but really throughout the news sphere around the world. We're interested in the ways that citizen media, that blogging, can help bring new voices into the fold. But the problem is, when you have 100 million people publishing, it's very hard to know who you might be interested in. We try to take on this role of editing and gatekeeping and help people try to find conversations that they might be interested in, try to add enough context to them so that people are able to participate in these conversations, and also take on translation. Because one of the real interesting challenges about today's internet is that it's a polyglot internet. We are heading towards a point where there's probably as much content nowadays in Chinese as there is in English. And if you're not a Chinese speaker, that's inaccessible to you. So we're trying to build those bridges through interested individuals who are trying very, very hard to make sure that people break out of their own national and linguistic echo chambers.
800-433-8850 is the number to call. Allow me to go to Alan in Rockville, Maryland. Alan, you are now on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello.
Hi,
yeah,
Alan.
I wanted to raise an information issue that I don't think has been mentioned. It may have been at the very beginning of the program. I missed it. But basically, the internet, or the original concept of the internet, was as a scholarly resource. And I know this as a scientist. I see it every day because I'm a principal in a small biotech, and we don't have library resources that, say, a big university has or a large corporation has. And the content, the really powerful intellectual content on the internet, which is vast, is basically locked away. It's only for pay. If you're going to go to Spring River Log, or you're going to go to Academic or any of the major intellectual presses, you've got to pay for every article. And all of that is locked away from the public. And even the properly digested part. So, I mean, I talk to a lot of people who aren't educated in science because I'm a gardener. And they don't know anything about global warming, and they have very, very retrograde views. But they never look at a copy of Nature or Science. They don't even see the digested parts of the articles because they can't get at it. I think this is a major problem. The internet could be a source for really high-quality information. It's locked away. Taxpayers should be asked to support a real opening of that information. A lot of it's technical, but a lot of it's digested too as part of the whole process. But all of it's locked away, and I think that's a giant problem.
Cass Sunstein.
Well, we're at the Democratic Convention, and I tend to like Senator Obama, and we don't get really excited about increasing taxes, except when it's necessary for various indispensable and valuable social goals. This is an indirect non-answer. I guess what I'd say about this is that with respect to climate change, the problem you raise, and many technical issues, you really can get a ton for free on the internet. So if you want to learn stuff, the Social Science Research Network, SSRN.com, is available. It has a lot on climate change. So I think the problem the caller points to is overstated. There's a lot of technical stuff out there that's free. It is true that a lot of the academic stuff you can't get unless you pay for it. But this is a complicated matter that for some publishers and some authors, the economic incentive is a useful spur to productivity, especially for publishers. We don't want to socialize the world of publications, that there's a place for things you have to pay for, a place for things that are free. It's an interesting suggestion that the government should subsidize universal access to certain scientific information. I don't mean to trivialize that, but among the various things that the taxpayers should be paying for now, it's not clear that that's an exceedingly high priority given the availability of lots of technical stuff that's already there and that is free.
Ethan Zuckerman, here's this email we got from Jonathan in Rockville, Maryland. While I agree that forums and social websites like Facebook can narrow your view, what would you say about the blogosphere? As a blogger myself, I found it to be unmatched in the amount of crosstalk I get and the unexpected news I receive from other bloggers and from comments on my own blog. What would your guests say to that? Ethan, in addition to that, how are the bloggers that you feature on Global Voices covering this presidential election?
Well, let me answer that last question first and say that one of the projects we've been running at Global Voices is a website called Voices Without Votes. It's at voiceswithoutvotes.com. And this was our attempt to sort of look at the presidential election from the outside and look at what people in the developing world are saying about the election. And we've been really surprised and encouraged by how much dialogue there has been in the developing world about the U.S. elections. It hasn't been hugely diverse. I would say that if the international community could vote, we would see a landslide for Senator Obama, which isn't a bad thing, but it's certainly a biased view of the world. But we've been trying our best to sort of open up that conversation. Look, I'm a blogger as well, not only through Global Voices. I have a personal blog as well. And that experience for me has been the experience of sort of deepening the world of information. I think anecdotally, there's a huge amount of evidence that bloggers, good bloggers, dig in, try to get a lot of opinions, even if they're looking for opinions to respond to them, to refute them. But I also think we all have to take a real hard look at what opinions and what topics we're looking for. There was a very good study done by Professor Henry Farrell at George Washington, and he looked at a set of about 5,000 people who say they read political blogs quite often. And there was extremely tight alignment between those people's politics and the politics of the blogs that they read. He basically tried to figure out whether people were carnivores or omnivores. Carnivores were people who only ate from their ideological side of the spectrum. Omnivores ate from both sides. And in the sample that he looked at, he only found 6% omnivores. So most of the people out there were looking a great deal at blogs that sort of reinforce their political opinion. I would argue that if you go and look at the sort of subjects that I'm worried about whether people are really getting a diverse international view of news, I would say that most bloggers that I read in the U.S. don't read a ton of international blogs or a ton of developing world blogs. And the reason that I'm interested in this issue and the reason that I run a project like Global Voices is to try to challenge people to break out of whatever echo chambers they might find themselves in.
You know, Cass Sunstein, I'd be fascinated to find out where you think that bloggers fall in the pantheon of what you call choice architects. In your new book, Nudge, you talk about choice architects, people who have the power to affect how we make decisions. Who are the choice architects when it comes to the news we access today on the Internet, and what responsibility should they bear?
That's a great topic. And the idea of a choice architect is that when we're making decisions about what to read, what stories to focus on, what to eat, what to do with our mortgages, there's an architect probably in the background who isn't necessarily aware of the architecture that he or she is helping to create. Nonetheless, there is an architecture behind our choices. The New York Times is a choice architect. If it puts on the top of a story, of the top of the headline, something about some scandal involving McCain, it's going to architect your eyes in that direction. If it puts something about an international issue right there, even though Americans maybe aren't that curious about it, it'll create an architecture. So the most important of the choice architects on the Internet are the people who design the sites that are most widely viewed. Ethan is himself a choice architect who's attempting to spur attention to international issues. Any blogger has a function as a choice architect. It could be a really pitifully uninfluential role like mine. I blog at the University of Chicago Law School faculty blog, which no one reads. Shows probably good judgment.
You know that's not true, but go ahead.
Well, very few. Hundreds. Hundreds. My
If you blogged more often, we'd read it more often.
Thank you very much. So there are some that aren't so influential, and there are others that are really influential. But just the layout and design of a blog, what's in capital letters, what is focused on in the first paragraph. Sometimes choice architects, whether they're doctors or real estate agents, are acutely aware of their architecture of choices. Sometimes they just are, they go about doing it and not focusing so much on what they're doing with people's eyeballs and attention.
We have joined the Architects of Choices because the Kojo Namdi Show blog is going up even as we speak, and it's my understanding that one reader has already poured in. We have time for just one more call in this segment. Let's go to Anne in Washington, D.C. Anne, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a journalist. I've been working in daily journalism for a long time, and I agree with your guest that there's this atomization of viewpoints going on out there because of the internet, and that a lot of it is because of the context. One other issue too is time. I mean, you can go to a blog, and there'll be many links. But it's usually the sort of nesting doll effect where you go deeper and deeper into your own ideological view. One thing I wanted to ask Ethan is you put some of the blame on what the news, the electronic media, the news media have been doing for the last 20 or 30 years where they're narrowing viewers' focus away from international news to more, you know, local news even, like fires and killings and so on. Can you tell me a little bit about how you think that happened, and also you too, Cass, how you think that this happened, why, and you know, and is there any way of reversing it? Thank you.
First, you, Ethan.
There's an excellent new study out from the Project on Excellence in Journalism that did interviews with over 200 newspaper editors and asked them what they thought was really important to the success of their newspapers. And the vast majority of these editors said that they were increasing local coverage and increasing hyper-local coverage, and only 10% of them said that international news was very important to their newspapers. They refer to this as the narrowing of the ambitions of the newspaper. We've basically gotten to the point that there's really only a few newspapers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, maybe the LA Times, that are really trying to be your single resource for all the information around the world. And what that means is that the resources to give you international news have really fallen away. They're doing this for economic reasons. They realize that they're competing with the internet, with the ability to go to Google News or Yahoo News and get deep international news. The thing that we're giving up international news in a local newspaper is the fact that the newspaper forces us to trip over that international news, whether we're looking for it or not, and it tries to contextualize it for us locally. There are people who are trying to solve this problem. Philip Balboni, who built New England Cable News up here in New England, is now starting a new website called Global News Enterprises, focused specifically on international news. And that's great that he's going to have 70 stringers out around the world, but it doesn't solve the attention problem. How do you ensure that people get the sort of international news that they really need to be responsible, engaged citizens? I don't think we've done a very good job of figuring out how we solve this in a digital age.
Ethan Zuckerman is a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University and co-founder of Global Voices, a website geared towards shining light on places and people other media often ignore. Ethan Zuckerman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Cass Sunstein, you'll be joining us in our next segment, so you won't be leaving us. I just wanted to know if you wanted to quickly respond to Anne's question.
I think Ethan's response is completely right, that it's market-driven and economics are crucial. And one response to this really is if we're consumers, we can try to think of look for things that aren't standard fare and indicate we actually are curious. And those who are producing material can think to themselves, look, we are performing a vital civic function. We're not just part of a standard market where we're trying to satisfy consumers' preferences. We're part of democracy.
Cass Sunstein is a professor at Harvard University, and he will be staying with us for our next segment on Supreme Court justices. So you stay with us, too, and you can call us at 800-433-8850. How an Obama administration is likely to look at the issue of judicial nominees. I'm Kojo Namdi. Coming up at 1, our roadshow at the DNC continues, how the legacy of the historic 1968 convention lives on, plus imagining what an Obama Supreme Court would look like. Today at 1 on the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, it's Tell Me More from NPR News.
Next time on Tell Me More, our coverage from Denver and the Democratic National Convention continues with a special Mocha Moms. Who in Congress supports legislation that benefits working families? We'll find out who made the cut. I'm Cheryl Corley. We'll talk about family-friendly policymakers. That's next time on Tell Me More.
And that's coming up at 2 o'clock, right after the Kojo Namdi Show, here on WAMU 88.5. Then at 3, it's Fresh Air.
On the next Fresh Air, an in-depth comparison of the Obama and McCain health care proposals. We talk with Jonathan Oberlander, who wrote about the partisan divide in health care in the New England Journal of Medicine. Also, Pam Brady and Andrew Fleming talk about writing and directing their new movie, Hamlet 2. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
That's coming up at 3 o'clock today, here on WAMU 88.5. Then at 4 o'clock, we'll get an update on all the day's top news on All Things Considered. And at 6 this evening on Marketplace, an update on all the day's business headlines, plus the latest numbers. That's Marketplace at 6 this evening here on WAMU 88.5.
January will be moving time for federal employees and political appointees across the country, but judges on the federal circuit and at the Supreme Court won't need to go looking for cardboard boxes or crates. They're on the bench for life. And their influence on the legal system can last for decades after the president who put them there leaves the White House. Joining us in Denver to measure the footprint President Bush will leave on America's judicial system and what a Democratic victory would mean for the Supreme Court is Cass Sunstein, Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. Welcome back once again, Cass.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
It's a decision that can cement a president's legacy, choosing a Supreme Court nominee, and the next president might have the chance to make two of those choices in his first term. What do you think that Barack Obama, the candidate you support and sometimes advise informally, would take?
The first thing to know is that Senator Obama is himself a constitutional specialist who has the credentials to be on the Supreme Court. And we haven't had someone as knowledgeable about the details of constitutional law in the White House for a very long time. This is something he taught for over a decade, and he genuinely qualifies as a constitutional scholar. So we would expect to see from an Obama presidency really people of tremendous merit. And that may sound a little dull, but it serves the country well to have people who are not merely first-rate, but the best in the country. The second thing to say is that we've seen a kind of quiet but really important revolution in the United States over the last 20 years, where the Supreme Court has been shifted really quite radically to the right. There hasn't been a lot of talk about this because the decisions are always 5-4, and they're always going to be 5-4 because the cases that get there are going to split the ones who are there. But the court is very far to the right compared to where it was in 1980. It's almost unimaginable how far it's gone to the right. And Senator Obama would not appoint ideologues or people who are liberals in the political sense. He'd appoint real judges. But they wouldn't follow the kind of standardized conservative line which has created major changes in the law in a way that's affected people's daily lives in the last 20 years. This is a fancy way of saying he'd appoint people who were more moderate, more cautious, less radical in their aspirations for changing our constitutional principles than some of the conservatives have been over the last 20 years.
Speaking of conservative, President Bush appointed two such conservative judges to the bench during his second term. What would another Republican administration imply or mean for the future of the court?
There's been a lot of talk in the last decade about something called the Constitution in Exile. And what that means is the Constitution of 1930s before President Roosevelt. A lot of conservatives believe that the 1930s Constitution was the right Constitution. Under that Constitution, the power of Congress was sharply limited. Some of the environmental statutes would be struck down. The court actually has struck down some of the anti-discrimination statutes. It's struck down parts of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So more conservatives would undoubtedly put a lot of pressure on some environmental laws and some anti-discrimination laws, both in interpreting them and in striking them down. In terms of the president's power to do such things as hold people without hearings, there's no question that conservative appointees would be more likely to give a blank check to the president. Roe against Wade hasn't gotten much attention, but the right to choose is hanging by a thread, and under a McCain presidency, there's a quite reasonable chance that Roberts and Alito, the two Bush appointees, would join Scalia and Thomas and a McCain appointee to overrule Roe against Wade and to threaten jail sentences for women and doctors in some states who have abortions. The right of privacy as a whole would be jeopardized. Many of the conservative judges don't believe that there is in the Constitution a right of privacy in the sense that the court has recognized one. So a McCain judicial appointment could mean a really very dramatic change in the nature of constitutional understandings, discrimination, environmental law, privacy rights, presidential power, everything under the sun.
I guess you should know that we'll be discussing this same issue at the Republican convention next week in St. Paul, Minnesota. But you can call us right now at 800-433-8850. That's 800-433-8850. Or you can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Speaking of the Republican Party and John McCain, he talks a lot about judicial activism and how it's threatening our democracy, but you've written that the judges with the least restraint on the Supreme Court are the most conservative. How does your definition of judicial activism differ from the one that John McCain and the Republicans offer?
The Republicans on judicial activism, I must say, and I have a lot of respect for Senator McCain, but on judicial activism, their position is it has really serious problems, and I'm trying to put it as generously as possible. They seem to define judicial activism as decisions that depart from conservative ideology. So when the court strikes down affirmative action laws or strikes down campaign finance laws, they don't consider that activism. When the court strikes down environmental laws or interprets them narrowly, that's not activism. So this is a very puzzling understanding that identifies activism with departure from political conservatism. The way I define activism in measuring it for purposes that at least are of some use is to see how often the decisions of, let's say, the Environmental Protection Agency or the National Labor Relations Board are struck down by a judge. How often does a judge actively say that a decision by an agency is unlawful? If a judge says that a lot, we define that as activist. If a judge does it very little, we define that judge as restrained. Now, that definition has the advantage that it's completely neutral. A judge who's striking down lots of environmental regulations, maybe that's a wonderful judge, but it's activist by our definition. We don't build in our political preferences into our definition. By this definition, which judges are striking down the most regulations, Justice Scalia turns out to be the most activist on the court, and the most restrained turns out to be Justice Breyer. That would probably surprise Senator McCain, but it's just the numbers. I didn't make that up. That's just what the numbers show.
You also measured whether justices have more frequently voted in favor of challenges mounted by public interest groups as opposed to challenges by corporations in order to measure the justices' partisanship. What was your finding there?
We found that Justice Thomas was the most partisan of the justices, that if the agency does something conservative, he is 46% more likely to uphold it than if it does something liberal. We found Justice Kennedy, a Reagan appointee, incidentally, is the most neutral. Basically, he shows no difference. So Thomas is the most partisan. The second most partisan, incidentally, is Justice Stevens, frequently characterized as a liberal justice, and he does show a strong preference for liberal agency decisions. He's very partisan, not as partisan, though, as Justice Thomas.
We're talking with Cass Sunstein. He is the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, and we're discussing Supreme Court justices and judicial nominees in general and what that might look like under an Obama administration, because we are here at the Democratic National Convention in Denver, Colorado, where Senator Obama will be the nominee of the Democratic Party for president, and inviting your calls at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. How do you think the Supreme Court will change with new leadership in the White House, whether it is a Republican or Democrat? 800-433-8850. As we said, you can send your email to kojo@wamu.org. Is it too early to speculate with names, or do you consider that there are people that Senator Obama would definitely or should definitely consider for the Supreme Court?
I think it's too early if we're trying to make a judgment that's solid, that anything we'd say now in terms of names would be speculative. But I'll give you one name of someone I personally believe should be on a short list, and I'm not speaking in any sense for the Obama campaign. I am an informal advisor, but this is purely my own view, which is that Diane Wood, who's on the Seventh Circuit, has a lot of support among Republican senators as well as Democratic senators. She's really a judge's judge. She's very highly regarded by Democratic and Republican appointees alike on the Seventh Circuit. And whether or not she's the very best choice, it's much too soon to say. We need to investigate records. She's a person of tremendous integrity and ability. As I say, she's widely respected by all sides. And she's a workhorse. She's a brilliant judge, and she's not someone who has any kind of partisan agenda.
The name Hillary Clinton has come up. What do you think are her chances?
I wouldn't want to speculate about Senator Clinton as a Supreme Court justice. I don't know if she has any interest in that. I would say, though, that she is someone who is tremendously able, and unlike many senators who don't specialize in any sense in constitutional law, Senator Clinton really does know constitutional law exceedingly well. So she would be she certainly has all the ability in the background. But as I say, this is someone who hasn't had judicial experience, and whether she'd want it and whether she'd be this is the ideal job for her, it's much too early to say.
How about someone who is a proponent of judicial minimalism, which, as you know, is a theory that judges should hew closely to the facts and cases before them rather than issuing forth with bold and sweeping opinions, a man who clerked for Justice Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court? I'm suspecting that you won't want to comment on the possibility or likelihood of him being appointed. A guy named, Cass Sunstein?
I don't know that guy. I've never heard that name before.
You too can call us, 800-433-8850. Here is Bob in Beltsville, Maryland. Bob, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. It was a very interesting show today, by the way, so thank you very much for these guests. I just wanted to say that I have to take issue with your guest description of an activist judge as one who's more likely to overturn regulations. Perhaps I heard that wrong, but that doesn't really match what I would think of as an activist judge. What I would think of as an activist judge is a judge who's willing to find things in the Constitution that are not written there but are implied somehow or logical extensions, and thereby give some of these things that are not written in the Constitution the authority of constitutionality, as opposed to a judge who is more inclined to look precisely at what the language says and what the people voted on when they voted for the Constitution. And I wondered if you'd comment on that or expand on that a little bit.
I understand the point. My definition, as I say, is a neutral definition of activism. You might be saying that you think a judge's activist if he departs from the original understanding of the text. If that's what you're saying, I have kind of two things to say about that. First, judges then who strike down affirmative action programs, who protect property rights against aggressive regulation, who protect lots of forms of speech that wouldn't have been protected at the original founding era, lots of judges who ban sex discrimination, probably judges who strike down racial segregation. All of those are activists by your definition. So we would be authorizing, in the name of restraint, I guess, on your view, racial segregation, certainly in the District of Columbia and very possibly throughout the country, in the interest of restraint. I think there's a problem with that conception of what counts as restraint and activism. Even if you disagree with that and you really want to insist on the original understanding, even if it means the government can discriminate on the basis of race, can discriminate on the basis of sex, can regulate lots of forms of speech, even if you want to insist on that, then we need to defend the view that the Constitution should be interpreted by reference to the original understanding of the Constitution. And that's a very controversial view of constitutional interpretation. It's only held by two members of the current court. One of the ones who holds it, that is Justice Scalia, has described himself as a faint-hearted originalist. That is, he doesn't insist on the original understanding in cases where the precedents cut very hard against it for a long period. So I think you're defining restraint and activism by reference to a theory of interpretation, which is not easy to defend. And it's not clear, by the way, that the framers and ratifiers themselves held that theory of interpretation. So the view that the Constitution means what it originally meant might be self-defeating, because the original understanding might not have been the Constitution means what it originally meant. In any case, I think your approach builds into our conception of activism and restraint a theory of interpretation, so ends up being circular. But I appreciate the point.
Some people on the left criticize Senator Obama's reactions to recent Supreme Court decisions on gun control in the District of Columbia and the death penalty, saying that it seemed Obama was veering toward the center. What did those cases reveal to you about Senator Obama's legal philosophy?
Senator Obama has long believed that the Second Amendment creates an individual right to have guns for non-military purposes. So I wasn't at all surprised when he expressed approval of the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Constitution to create a right to have guns for non-military purposes. Senator Obama has also been a longtime believer in the death penalty in certain cases of egregious crime. And I wasn't surprised at all to see him say that in certain cases involving rape of children, he thought the death penalty is constitutional.
And I'm afraid that's about all the time we have. Cass Sunstein is a professor at Harvard Law School and an informal advisor to Senator Barack Obama's presidential campaign. Cass Sunstein, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Nandi Show, our live broadcast from the Democratic National Convention continues. Two lawyers-turned-radio hosts take us inside Denver's rough-and-tumble politics, plus how Americans living abroad affect party politics back home. We talk with the delegates who traveled to Colorado from Africa and Europe. The Kojo Nandi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. Coming up next here on WAMU 88.5, it's the second